Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now going to begin a study of the book of Joel, the second of the minor prophets. We did Hosea last audio, finished him up, and now we're going to start on Joel. I'll call this chapter An Invasion of Locusts, and we will give a little bit of introduction before we get into it. The author, who is the author? Well, we know very little about Joel. We know the name of his father because verse 1 says he's the son of Pethuel, but we don't know anything about his father, so that's basically meaningless. As Albert Barnes says, we know that Joel was not a priest. Why? Because he mentions the priest as a class to which he did not belong. We read in Joel 1:9, Joel says, "Grain and drink offerings have been cut off from the house of the Lord. The priests, who are ministers of the Lord, mourn." Sounds like he's talking about a body different than himself. It's not conclusive, but it sounds that way. Joel 2:17, "Let the priest, the Lord's ministers, weep between the portico and the altar." He doesn't say, "Let us, the priest, weep," but he says, "Let the priest." So it does sound like he's not a priest. And in Joel 1:13, Joel says, "Dress in sackcloth and lament, you priest." You priest, sounds like he's talking about a group different than himself. "Wail, you ministers of the altar." That doesn't sound like he's including himself in the category of priests and ministers. "Come and spend the night in sackcloth, you ministers of my God." So we know he's not a priest. Where did he live? Most probably in Jerusalem. The only evidence we have is internal, but the internal evidence is pretty strong. Joel was living in the center of the public worship of God, as we shall see. He speaks to the priest as though he were present in Joel 1, verses 13 through 14. I just read verse 13. "Dress in sackcloth and lament, you priest." Well, where are the priests? They're in Jerusalem. "Wail, you ministers of the altar. Come and spend the night in sackcloth, you ministers of my God, because grain and drink offerings are withheld from the house of your God." That's the temple. That's in Jerusalem. "Announce a sacred fast. Proclaim an assembly. Gather the elders and all the residents of the land at the house of the Lord your God." Well, that's the temple in Jerusalem. Joel was where a solemn assembly would be held. In chapter 2, verses 15 through 17, we read this, "Blow the horn in Zion, announce a sacred fast," and it would be the priest who would do that. I think some translations have consecrate a sacred fast. "Proclaim an assembly," the priest would do that. "Gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the aged, gather the children, even those nursing at the breast. Let the groom leave his bedroom and the bride her honeymoon chamber. Let the priest, the Lord's ministers, weep between the portico and the altar." This is in an assembly where there's a little bit of public mourning going on. The portico, of course, is the porch, the gate that leads into the holy place of the temple. The altar is right in front of that door. And, of course, the priest would be standing between the front porch of the holy place and the bronze altar of burnt offering right there in the middle, and they'll be crying, "Let them say, have pity on your people, Lord, and do not make your inheritance a disgrace," and so forth. Okay, solemn assembly would be right there in Jerusalem. And as I mentioned earlier, he mentions house of the Lord in verse 14 of chapter 1, "Gather the elders at the house of the Lord your God." The house of the Lord, that's the temple. Joel 1:9, "Grain and drink offerings have been cut off from the house of the Lord." So he mentions the temple. And he also mentions Zion, which is the traditional metonymy for Jerusalem. A metonymy is a figure of speech, a part for a whole. And Zion was a mountain in Jerusalem, a part of Jerusalem, which stood for the whole city of Jerusalem. Joel 2:1, "Blow the horn in Zion. Sound the alarm, O my holy mountain." Blow the horn in Jerusalem. Joel 2:15, "Blow the horn in Zion. Announce a sacred fast." Again, blow the horn in Jerusalem. Joel 2:23, "Children of Zion, children of Jerusalem, rejoice and be glad in the Lord your God." So, he's in Jerusalem. And to top it all off, he mentions the restoration of Judah and Jerusalem, but not northern Israel. Of course, Judah and Jerusalem were the capital province and capital city of the southern kingdom of Judah, which consisted of two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. The other 10 tribes were in the north, north of Benjamin. But Joel mentions Judah and Jerusalem, but not northern Israel. In Joel 3:1, we read, "Yes, in those days and at that time when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem," but not northern Israel. He doesn't mention northern Israel. Joel 3:20, "But Judah will be inhabited forever and Jerusalem from generation to generation." Barnes says the absence of any direct promise of the extension of those blessings to the 10 tribes, such as occur in Hosea and Amos, implies that Joel had no office in regard to them in regard to the 10 tribes. So we know that Joel is preaching against the southern kingdom of Judah. He's not messing with the northern 10 tribes. Now there is apparently a relationship with the prophet Amos and Amos's book. This is from Albert Barnes, who says that Joel must have completed his prophecy before Amos completed his prophecy. Amos takes as a keynote of his prophecy words near the end of Joel. Let's see that. Joel 3:16, "The Lord will roar from Zion and raise his voice from Jerusalem. Heaven and earth will shake, but the Lord will be a refuge for his people, a stronghold for the Israelites." That's Joel. Now listen to Amos 1, verse 2. He said, "The Lord roars from Zion and raises his voice from Jerusalem." Now the rest of the verse is not quite the same. "The pastures of the shepherds mourn and the summit of Carmel withers." That's a little bit different. But this phrase, "The Lord will roar from Zion and raise his voice from Jerusalem," that's in Joel 3:16, and Amos 1:2, "The Lord roars from Zion and raises his voice from Jerusalem." The exact same thing, basically. So there's a connection. Well, now, let's talk about the date of Joel. Nobody knows, really. The date is not specified within the book, but now if we can connect Joel with the book of Amos, as we just did, and if we can date Amos, then that would put Joel shortly before Amos. Now, Amos was active about 750, according to Wikipedia, and Lambert Dolphin, one of my sources for timelines, has Joel active during the reign of Judah's king Joash, who ruled from 835 to 796. So that would put Joel somewhere between 800 and 750, but that's pretty iffy. Albert Barnes says, "Nor again does anything in Joel's own prophecy suggest any particular date beyond what is already assigned through the relation which the book of Amos bears to his book," as I've just mentioned. Now, an article from Ligonier Study Center down in Florida, R.C. Sproul's outfit, says that the lack of certainty concerning the date rarely affects the interpretation of the book. It's no big deal that we don't know when the book was written. The Ligonier article says that most scholars date the book prior to the Babylonian exile or the immediate post-exilic period, which is a good ways off from 750. Just prior to the Babylonian exile, that was 586, so that's a lot later. Again, the dates are all over the place. The speculations are all over the place. However, I must say a date prior to the Babylonian exile would fit nicely because of all the doom and gloom that Joel prophesies about. That would fit nicely what the Babylonians did to Judah in 586. We'll see as we get into the book. So, with that background, let's read verse 1. "The word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel." Now, Yoel might be the best way to pronounce that. I'm not sure what the Hebrew is. I can guess the Hebrew. The Y sound, the Yod sound in Hebrew, gets anglicized to a J. Yahweh becomes Jehovah. Joel is probably Yah, which is short for Yahweh. And El, of course, means God. And so the name Joel means Yahweh is God. That's a nice name for a prophet. His father was Pethuel, which means persuaded of God, as Albert Barnes says. We go now to verses 2 through 7 in Joel chapter 1. "Hear this, O elders, and listen, all inhabitants of the land. Has anything like this happened in your days or in your father's days? Tell your sons about it, and let your sons tell their sons, and let their sons the next generation. What the gnawing locust has left, the swarming locust has eaten. And what the swarming locust has left, the creeping locust has eaten. And what the creeping locust has left, the stripping locust has eaten. Awake, drunkards, and weep, and wail, all you wine drinkers, on account of the sweet wine that is cut off from your mouth. For a nation has invaded my land, mighty and without number. Its teeth are the teeth of a lion, and it has the fangs of a lioness. It has made my vine a waste and my fig tree splinters. It has stripped them bare and cast them away. Their branches have become white." Well, let's look at these locusts. In verse 4, we have a gnawing locust, a swarming locust, a creeping locust, and a stripping locust. Four different Hebrew words for those four different kinds of locust. Actually, altogether, there were 9 Hebrew words for locust, 4 of them used here. Now, those different Hebrew words could signify something. Albert Barnes thinks so, but other people think that the differences signify nothing. They're just used, the different words are used for a poetic effect. I tend to think that the words meant something. Different kinds of locust destroying the vegetation of Israel. Now, the very fact that Hebrew has 9 different words to indicate a locust, either different species of locust or different levels of maturity of a locust. That shows that the Jews had a real problem with locusts. It's difficult for modern people to appreciate the dire threat of a locust plague in earlier periods of time. In 1988, there was a civil war in Chad in Africa, and that civil war prevented international cooperation in attacking the hatch of locusts, and so a destructive swarm of locusts spread through North Africa, devastating some of the poorest nations and threatening Europe as well. Locusts are nothing to sneeze at. This is what a gentleman on the internet named Raymond Dillard says about locusts. Such outbreaks had serious consequences for the health and mortality of an affected population and for a region's economy. Scarcity of food resulting from the swarm's attack would bring the population to subsistence intake or less, would make the spread of disease among a weakened populace easier, would eliminate any trade from surplus food products, and would stimulate high inflation in the cost of food products. Disease outbreaks are further aggregated when swarms die. The putrefaction of the millions of locust bodies breeds typhus and other diseases that spread to humans and animals. Yowza. So these locusts were a terrible, terrible plague. Now, scholars disagree over whether the locust symbolized actual human armies or whether it was just a natural disaster hitting Israel. Again, it's hard to know. We don't know Joel's dates. If he was writing before the Babylonian invasion in 586, well, then I guess it would refer to the Babylonians stripping the place bare. We go now to Joel 1:8. Joel continues, "Wail like a virgin girded with sackcloth for the bridegroom of her youth." Now, that word virgin in the Hebrew is bethula, which signifies a young woman or bride. That word does not signify virgin, the proper Hebrew for which is alma, as Adam Clark points out. So it's either a young woman or a bride. Probably not a virgin, but it could be because the NASB translates it that way. So what we have here is a couple of options. This could be a virgin whose betrothed was killed, the bridegroom of her youth, bridegroom being the man that was betrothed to her but not actually married to her. That's why she was still a virgin. Or it could be a young wife who was actually married to her husband, and so therefore she was no longer a virgin, but her husband got killed. But at any rate, that's pretty sad when a woman loses her husband or her betrothed. Deep, deep bitterness and grief. And Joel compares that grief to what's going to happen to Israel when those locusts come. Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as grief like a young woman instead of like a virgin. We go now to Joel 1 verses 9 through 13. "The grain offering and the drink offering are cut off from the house of the Lord. The priests mourn, the ministers of the Lord. The field is ruined, the land mourns, for the grain is ruined, the new wine dries up, fresh oil fails. Be ashamed, O farmers, wail, O vine dressers, for the wheat and the barley, because the harvest of the field is destroyed. The vine dries up and the fig tree fails, the pomegranate, the palm also, and the apple tree. All the trees of the field dry up. Indeed, rejoicing dries up from the sons of men. Gird yourselves with sackcloth and lament, O priest. Wail, O ministers of the altar. Come spend the night in sackcloth, O ministers of my God, for the grain offering and the drink offering are withheld from the house of your God." Now, that's easy to understand. It's just whoa, 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 because everything's going to get whacked, everything agricultural. And so put sackcloth on and lament. One minor translation issue here. After we hear the vine dries up and the fig tree fails, the pomegranate, the palm, and the apple tree fails, the NASB has in the margin the apricot tree fails. Translation, doesn't matter. Everything, all the trees of the field dry up, as verse 12 says. And the priests are so sad. The grain offering and the drink offering, those are standard offerings that went along with the animal offerings. They're gone. There's no grain growing anymore. There are no grapes growing anymore, so where are you going to get grain offerings? The loaves, the cakes. Where are you going to get the drink offerings? We go now to Joel chapter 1, verses 14 through 20, and we will finish this chapter. Joel continues, "Consecrate a fast, proclaim a solemn assembly, gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land to the house of the Lord your God, and cry out to the Lord. Alas for the day of the Lord is near, and it will come as destruction from the Almighty. Has not food been cut off before our eyes? Gladness and joy from the house of our God. The seed shrivel under their clods. The storehouses are desolate. The barns are torn down, for the grain is dried up. How the beast groan. The herds of cattle wander aimlessly because there is no pasture for them. Even the flocks of sheep suffer. To thee, O Lord, I cry, for fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness, and the flame has burned up all the trees of the field. Even the beasts of the field pant for thee, for the water brooks are dried up, and fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness. Now in verse 14, Joel suggests to his audience that they consecrate a fast. That was the priest's duty to consecrate a fast. So he's talking to the priest. And he tells them in verse 15 that the day of the Lord is near. Now the day of the Lord is a common phrase. It means destruction coming on somebody. And the use of this word here shows, at least to me, that the phrase does not always refer to the end of the world. I believe what he's talking about here is the end of Jerusalem, the day of the Lord. Now, when this happened is hard to say, and the scholars are split all over the place on it. But when we get to chapter 2, I'm going to make the case that the day of the Lord is referring to AD 70, and I think I can make a pretty strong case for that. But wherever it is, or whenever it is, it could very well be a type of the final day of the Lord when God wipes out the rebellious of the world. But I don't think so, because here it's the rebellious of Jerusalem that gets wiped out. There's no Gentiles are involved. I think it's what happened to the Jews in AD 70. Now, if it was referring to what happened from the Babylonians in 586 BC, well, then I would just say that's a type of what happened in AD 70. It could be just a direct prophecy of what's going to happen in AD 70. It's not talking about anything else. It's hard to say exactly, but we'll get into that in chapter 2. I hope you stay with me for the discussion of chapter 2, and I hope you enjoy the discussion of chapter 1. See you next time.